Alrighty. We've been studying the review in the book of Revelation. Let's look at our overview chart before we launch here again this morning. The book organizes itself and tells us how it organizes itself in chapter 1, verse 19, past, present, and future. The Lord tells John, I want you to write down some things that you have seen, the things which are, and the things which you are going to see. So the book is past, present, and future. Chapter 1, the past, chapters 2 and 3, the present, the church age, and all of the rest of the book is the future. Chapters 4 through 22 in the book of Revelation hasn't happened yet. The others have, except for 2 and 3, there's, you know, they're happening as we go through them. So chapters 4 through 22, brought my pointer today. I hope I need that some point in time, but not this morning. Chapters 4 through 22 all have to do with the future. Now, that's a big section, isn't it? So we break it down a little further in that chapters 4 through 19 of this book all have to do with tribulation period judgments. What's a tribulation period? Well, it's Daniel's 70th week. What's Daniel's 70th week? What's Jacob's time of trouble? What's Jacob's time of trouble? It's a seven-year time period that begins with the signing of a treaty between the Antichrist and Israel and runs for 7 years, and it concludes with the second advent, the Lord coming all the way back to earth. We believe the rapture precedes that seven-year period of time, and we don't know by exactly how much. Maybe months, maybe a year or two, I don't know. But somehow or another, it appears, we believe this is a correct viewpoint, pre-tribulation rapture. The Lord will snatch his church off of the earth before that time period begins and these judgments ensue. So from chapters 4 through 19, all that's going to happen in the future. And in chapters 4 and 5, we are introduced to the judge. And in chapters 6 through 10, we will see judgments. Things that the judge is going to do to come back here and reclaim this planet from Satan, that great usurper. The Lord will come back and take back this planet, which is rightfully his, to rule over. So in chapters 6 through 10, where we are right now, we're focusing primarily on the events of this seven-year time frame. We're going to take another pass through it a little later, where we'll focus on the institutions and the personalities that play a main role. But for now, we're focusing upon events. And the way those events start to unfold is they're associated with seals and the breaking of seals on this scroll of judgments. Each one of those seals is a certain judgment on the earth. And so far we've seen six of those. The first four of them are sort of a package deal. Remember that? They have to do with war and the inevitable consequences of war. Cold War seems to be the beginning there in the White Horse. And the Antichrist perhaps being the writer there. But what follows, of course, is hot war and the inevitable consequences of hot war, famine and death. So those first four, sort of a package. That's why they're all horses, a symbol of warfare in John's day. Each of them has a rider representative of that particular aspect of war that is going to impact the earth. First four. You got any water back here, Pam? Grab me a little water if you would, please. Now, those first four, hot war and the inevitable consequences of hot war, will result in 1/4 of the world's population dying. How many people is that? 1/4 of the world's population. Thanks. It's about 1.7 billion, 1.8 billion, isn't it? If you assume the Earth's population, say right now, 7 billion, maybe a little bit more when this takes place. We're talking about billion, 1.6, 1.7, 1.8 billion people will die as a result of those four sealed judgments. We only know of two, there's only two judgments talked about in this book where we're given the death rate associated with them. So there's a bunch of other deaths that are due to other things, and we'll talk about that. But we know from these first four sealed judgments that 1/4 of the Earth's population will die as a result of those particular judgments. Probably not all right away. Remember, the lingering effects of war, you can die from an injury, an ailment, an illness or something like that a year or two or three later. But throughout the first half of the tribulation period, most of that will probably take place. Then we saw the sixth seal, which was the appeal of the martyrs, Christian martyrs, during that time frame for vengeance. And the Lord told them to kind of hold what they got, be patient, and he would eventually indeed take vengeance for their martyrdom. But that would come a little bit later. They had to wait on that. And then in the sixth seal involved a bunch of celestial things. Sky, mountains, earthquakes, and all kinds of physical ailment or judgments came from this seventh seal down here. So we've worked our way down through those first six seals, and that brings us up to chapter 7, where we want to continue on here this morning. All right, chapter 7, book of Revelation. After this, John says, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth. How do you stand at the corners of a sphere? I don't know. I suspect he saw one north, south, east, and west, you know, just kind of the symmetrical corners of the earth. And they're standing there, and they were holding back the four winds of the earth so that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. Now, our principle of interpreting this book is we interpret it literally unless we have a reason not to. So when John says they're holding back the four winds, we can interpret it literally. They're holding back certain aspects of the hydrological system of the earth. The earth functions with winds blowing, evaporating waters from the ocean. They rise, they cool, they form clouds, they rain, and that produces crops and all that stuff. You kind of understand that cycle, the hydrological cycle. These four angels maybe have some authority and power over that cycle. So when he sees them, it looks like they're holding back what is the normal functioning systems that sustain life here on this planet, that is, the winds. Now, that's one interpretation. That may be fine. But there's another possible one here I'll share with you in just a second. So there's four guys, four angels introduced, and here's a fifth one, verse 2. I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun. I guess that would be from the east, in other words, having a seal of the living God. So he's God's man. He's God's rep. He's speaking for God here. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. So those four angels that were introduced to there first, they have been given the authority to harm this planet. And this fifth angel, he comes in the scene, he says, time out, guys. Don't any of you four do anything to the planet yet. Hold what you got, because we got something else we got to do here. Now, if they are granted the abilities to harm the planet, the winds may not be just winds. They may be other forces at work as well. Maybe it is just the winds, because the winds and the lack thereof can harm the planet as well. So these guys are prepared now to harm the earth. And the fifth angel comes and calls time out. Says, don't do anything yet, because don't harm the earth or sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. Whoa. Don't do anything more, guys, until we physically seal certain individuals, they're called bondservants of God, with a mark, a certain kind of mark on their foreheads that will protect them against physical death during this time. Now, why do you think they have to have a special sealing to avoid physical death? Because the death rate is so high that if you don't do something special to seal somebody, they're going to get ground up in this thing. Life on this planet will be a total meat grinder. And so if you don't do something, there's no guarantee that anybody in particular will survive it. Remember what the Lord said about it. He said if this thing was allowed to go on any longer than the 7 years, nobody would survive, not even the elect. So there is a necessary function here that these guys have to play, and that is just to physically seal these certain individuals from physical death so that they for sure can make it through the 7 year period of time. Divine sealing, in other words, divine enablement, divine help to get through that period of time. Who are these guys? And what makes them so special? Well, John gives us some input on that, verse 4. He says, I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. These are Jews, and they will total 144,000. How about Gentiles? Are there any Gentiles sealed? Now, there's no indication that Gentiles are ever sealed. Now, there'll be some Gentiles make it through the 7 years. There'll be Gentiles alive to go into the millennial kingdom, but they're not sealed from physical death. Other circumstances will result in them living through it, but these guys will get the seal of God placed on them and will be protected from physical death through this 7 year meat grinder. And it's Israelites only, it's Jews only that are sealed. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed, and Reuben and Gad and Asher and Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, Benjamin. Well, that's it, Joseph and Benjamin. 12,000 from each of those 12 tribes. And notice who's not mentioned there. Daniel's not mentioned. Tribe of Dan is not mentioned. And, of course, Ephraim isn't mentioned, but Joseph is, and so that's probably him. So it may be that Dan is the only one. And the explanation that's usually given for that is that since Dan was so much of a leader in leading the nation into idolatry, maybe they are omitted and they don't get their 12,000 sealed. They just have to try to make it through like everybody else. So.
It would be more than 144,000.
I beg your pardon?
That would be more than 144,000.
Yeah, if there was any of them sealed, that's right. So to get to the 144,000, 12,000 Jews from each of those 12 tribes listed right there are protected physically from death during this time frame. Now, why? Who are these guys that they get this special treatment? Well, the Lord said that when the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom has reached all parts of the earth there, then the end will come. So I take it that there is a preaching of the gospel of the kingdom, which is the same thing that John the Baptist preached and the Lord preached when the Lord was here the first time, repent for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It looks like these guys are probably those spokespersons for God, preaching that gospel, the gospel of the kingdom. And who knows what else they might do, but they clearly are God's chosen people to do something for him. They're serving a function for God during the tribulation period. So early on in the tribulation period, these 12,000 guys are sealed to preach the gospel message throughout that 7 year period of time. Will other people also be saved and preach the gospel message? Yeah, I think there will be. But these guys we know are sealed. They for sure are going to make it through the 7 year period of time. All right, so as these four angels are ready to hammer the planet in some way, the fifth angel calls time out and says, don't do anything until we get these guys all sealed. And so they go through and they seal in a divine manner 12,000 from each of those 12 tribes. So there's 144,000 Jews hit the ground running during the tribulation period. So we went from a situation where there were no believers whatsoever on the planet following the rapture to where there's at least 144,000 godly men available to preach the message of the kingdom, I suspect, rather early on. We're not told exactly when, but it would make sense that it was pretty early on. Okay, so that's kind of an interlude, kind of a timeout for a little bit, called by this angel to get these guys sealed. So they do. There's actually at least two of these interludes that we'll see as we go through this book, where the action kind of breaks for a little bit until something else is done. And this is the first one of the two. Okay. Going on, John says, "Now after these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands." Who in the world are these guys? From every nation. Are they Jews? No, they're Gentiles, aren't they? He sees people from every nation there. He sees this big collection of Gentiles, and they have, notice what he says in describing them, they have ethnic distinctions there, don't they? How does he know they're from every tribe on earth? It looks like, from this incident here, that we retain our ethnicity in heaven. If you're a blue-eyed blonde here, you'll be a blue-eyed blonde there, I guess. If you're black here, you'll be black there. If you're brown here, you'll be brown there, and so on. It looks like whatever our ethnic backgrounds are, that is retained in our heavenly bodies as time goes on, because he says they're from every nation and tribes and peoples and tongues, so he recognizes the differences between them there. And they're clothed in white. That's usually a symbol of righteousness, of course, so these are would appear to be for sure believers. We'll see in just a moment who they are. And they cry out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to his Lamb." And all the angels standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures fell on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever." So this is a scene of heavenly worship on the part of this vast array of Gentile peoples that John observes here, and he observes them in their various ethnicities. Now, who are these guys? Is this the church? Oh, we've seen the church before, haven't we? Let's see if we can find out who these guys are. "One of the elders answered me, saying, 'These that are clothed in white robes, who are they, John? And from where have they come?' And I said to him, 'My Lord, you know.' And he said to me, 'These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, and they've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb.'" Who are these people? They've come out of the great tribulation. This isn't the church. Remember, the church left before the tribulation period began. These are believing martyrs that have been killed during the tribulation period that are now standing before the throne of God and worshiping him. So to those people who say that Revelation 3:10 that talks about the Lord keeping us from this time of testing and trial, they say, "Well, no, he'll just protect us through that." No, he won't. There's a big bunch of millions and millions of martyrs who were killed during the tribulation period. He doesn't protect the church through it. He takes the church off of the earth before it happens. So that argument doesn't hold any water at all. These are those that came out of the great tribulation. By the way, the Lord calls the second half of this seven-year interval the Great Tribulation. Now, the whole thing is tribulation, all 7 years, but he calls the second half of it, from 3.5 to 7 years, he calls it the Great Tribulation. So I don't know if John is using the term in the same way that the Lord used it, and these are the martyrs during just the second half, or if the whole thing is in mind here. I just don't know. But clearly, many believers will be killed, they will be martyred because of their faith during the tribulation period. An untold number of them here. And they're worshiping God. But they've been given these white robes. These are believers. And for this reason, they are before the throne of God, and they serve him day and night in his temple. What temple? Looks like there's a temple in heaven, doesn't it? Some commentators spiritualize all these references to any structures in heaven. I don't think that's correct. I think there are structures there. There is a physical temple, and we see functionings going on around it. It looks like God's throne room has a wall built around it because there's a door that John went through to get in there. So I think there are physical structures in heaven after which the ones on earth are patterned. Now, they may be made of something a little different than what we know of as like wood or something like that, but they appear to be there. We see this in a number of places. And here's a reference to his temple. And he who sits on the throne spread his tabernacle over them. That's kind of a reference back to Ruth 3:9, I think, where you remember Boaz, when Ruth, in essence, proposed to Boaz, he accepted by, in essence, putting his blanket over her. He covered her. That's a symbol of him taking care of and protecting her. This is the same thing. God has spread his cloak, his garment over these folks. They are now in his care, and they are believers that he will take care of throughout all eternity. And, yeah, Janelle?
And you're talking about the ones who made it through the tribulation and washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb.
No, they haven't made it through now. The only ones that make it through is 144,000 that we know of. These are martyrs that have died during the tribulation period, and the washing of their robes in the blood of the Lamb is a reference to their belief and faith. So they're with him now. They're departed spirits who got killed during the tribulation period, and they're in heaven with the Lord during that.
Okay, I guess my question was, who told them about the blood of the Lamb? Was it these Jewish?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
Evangelistic?
That's what I would think, yeah. Their message is a message of salvation. And I suspect they were brought to faith through the ministry of those 144,000. That may be why this scene takes place in your Bible right after the 144,000 are introduced to us, is that there's a...
A question's been concerning me. When you talked about initially the 12 tribes,
mm-hmm.
and you said Daniel was not there, well, there was only 12 tribes. Where is... And there's 12 here. So if Daniel, would be 13, that doesn't make sense.
Well, it depends on how you count Joseph's two sons. Remember, Joseph adopted Ephraim and Manasseh from Jacob, and so he has now two. So if you count just the number, if you don't count Joseph, but you count his two kids, you'd have 13.
Okay.
But usually the Levites are not involved in land and things of that sort, and so you end up usually with 12 getting the land and all that sort of stuff. They're provided for in other ways, the Levites are.
Right.
So it just kind of depends on what your list is and so on. And if we're guessing that maybe Daniel didn't have Dan, tribe of Dan, I keep calling Daniel, tribe of Dan, perhaps is excluded because they were very instrumental in leading the nation into idolatry. So this may be a judgment on them for that anyway. Okay. So... And here's the circumstances of these martyrs, verses 16 and 17 of chapter 7. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun beat down on them, or any heat. For the Lamb is in the center of the throne. The Lamb in the center of the throne shall be their shepherd, and shall guide them to springs of the water of life, and God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. Clearly that is a description of eternal bliss. These folks have arrived home to their heavenly state, and they will enjoy eternal bliss forevermore. And so they have, because of their martyr death, because of their belief in having been martyred, they're there in their heavenly scene. So chapter 7 now is kind of a timeout. We didn't see any events take place there. Well, unless you call the sealing an event, I guess you could say that. But in chapter 7, the 144,000 Jewish, these look like Jewish males, are sealed. And the martyrs that are not sealed are seen there in the heavenly scene. Okay, any questions about chapter 7? The fifth angel calls time out so that the four that were ready to hammer the planet don't do anything until this stuff takes place. Everybody okay with chapter 7? All right. Now, I told you before, as we approach this study, that there will be some things that you will have a hard time believing. The magnitude of some of these judgments is so extensive, it's so far outside any reference to experience that you have, that you'll have to struggle with believing them. But let me remind you of a principle. In the book of Hebrews, we're told that creation is understood by faith. That means you can't figure it out scientifically. You just have to accept what God tells you. Faith is believing what God says. And we're going to see that in these events going forward here. The seal judgments are one thing. We know a little bit about war and the consequences of war. But we're going to see some things now that you cannot refer back in your experience to. You're going to have to just take God at his word, which is what you should always do. Okay? So let's go on now into chapter 8. What we're going to see next are judgments that are associated with the blowing of trumpets. Now remember, the first four had to do with the breaking of seals. Well, when they break the seventh seal, seven more trumpet judgments take place. And later when we hear the seventh trumpet, we're going to get seven more bowl judgments take place. So it's kind of like a telescoping rod, you know. They come right out of each other so that all of the judgments are contained in the seven seals. Okay, chapter 8. When he broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Now, you all realize this is the proof text for the fact that there are no women in heaven at this time, right? If you ever want to prove that point, just come to this verse and show them that there can't be any women there, because for a half hour, nobody said anything. That gag's been around longer than I have, but I thought I'd use it anyway. Now, what's happened here is when he breaks that seventh seal, the heavenly host is so stunned by the contents that, man, it just puts a hush over everybody. They look at that and they, oh, my gosh. And they get their phones out and they start tweeting all their friends about what they see here and everything. They don't say a word, man. This is awesome what they seal. What they see, I mean. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. So each one of these angels now has a trumpet, and he will announce the seven trumpet judgments by blowing that trumpet, each one of their trumpets. And another angel, verse 3 of chapter 8, came and stood at the altar. Again, physical structures seen in the scene here. Holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him, that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which is before the throne. So this incense burning device that the angel carries is likened unto the prayers of the saints. So what goes up before God is represented by the incense, but it's the prayers of the saints on earth and wherever that it represents. And the smoke of the incense and the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hands. So what is driving this series of judgments now is the prayers of saints. They're asking God to take vengeance, to judge this earth, and to do this. And so this scene is one where the prayers of the saints, represented by the incense, goes up before God. And the angel took the censer, and he filled it with the fire of the altar, and he threw it to the earth, and there followed peals of thunder and sounds of flashes of lightning and an earthquake. Just mention just a simple earthquake. Don't say how big it is or how destructive it is or anything else. There's just an earthquake associated now with these seven trumpet judgments.
Prayers of the saints. What saints?
Well, the martyred ones we know have asked God to take vengeance upon them. It could be the saints, it could be the church, and it could be the saints still on the earth. So John doesn't give us that specific delineation because all of them would be appropriate. The church could be asking for this, the saints on the earth, which is probably who it is, could be asking for it, or the martyred saints that we saw there in that earlier scene in chapter 7.
It could be our prayers.
Beg your pardon?
It could be our prayers.
That's right, but remember, we're there now already, too. The church is already there.
Yeah.
But it would be appropriate for the church to pray that, too. So that's why I'm saying I'm not certain, but it could be any one of the three. So the seven angels that had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. Now, before we get into these, let me remind everybody that this planet that we live on is a life sustaining planet. God has built systems into this planet that sustain life, plant life, animal life, human life. It is our home, and everybody who has ever lives in that 150-mile crust on the face of the earth, and that crust, that 150-mile depth of crust, has supported all life throughout all of the history of the planet. It is a life-sustaining planet. It has systems in place to do that. What happens if you disrupt those systems? What if you don't get rain? What if you don't get seasons to grow crops? What if you don't get tidal movements and ocean functions and activities that support life on this planet? What do you think is going to happen to it? Well, what we're going to see next, the first four trumpet judgments are all directed at this planet and its life-supporting systems. God is going to go in and he is going to break down some of those systems. Much of this earth lives from payday to payday, don't they? Crop to crop. There's no reserve. They live from what they can grow in a season. I mean, it's kind of cut and dry. It's close. If you disrupt that somehow, what do you think is going to happen? Keep that in mind, and let's look and see what happens here. Verse 7. And the first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood. Now remember, when John says something like, it was like blood, or as it were blood, we got a little room to interpret. You can kind of tap dance around a little bit and come up with something. But when he says it became blood, it became blood. We have to take that literally. He didn't say it became red like blood. And this is, like I was saying earlier, some of these things are difficult to grasp, to be sure. But here comes this mixture of hail and fire and blood, and it was thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. Can you imagine that? Is that easy to grasp? A third of the earth's resources being burnt up. Now, it's possible that these judgments are regional, and it's possible that they're universal. It's easier to imagine them if they're regional, but they may not be. But interestingly enough, here's something I want you to see using my sophisticated pointer. You see this region right here in the Plain States and up into southern Canada? It's about a third of the Earth's produce is grown there. See this region right here in southern Russia and eastern and northern Europe? There's about a third of it is produced there. And then over here in India and up the Pacific Rim stuff over here, about another third of it is over here. So maybe this is a regional judgment, and maybe whatever strikes the planet at those areas, and it looks like it maybe is strong enough that it poisons all of the grass, but it actually kills some trees and other things. So it looks like somewhere about a third of the Earth's ability to grow vegetation and so on, is burned up and is destroyed by this first trumpet judgment. Got the picture there? About a third of the earth's ability to produce crops has now been eliminated. What's that do to the earth's population? We're not given a number like we are with the war, and we'll be given another number later, but it's the only two we get. But you know it has to be big, doesn't it? Take away a third of the earth's crop-growing capability, and the death rate has got to be extraordinary. Yeah, Janelle.
All through history, we've had droughts. We've had things where they didn't grow. But the difference in this is that with the blood.
Yes, and the extent is so great.
Yes.
I mean, a third of the earth. And whatever the infestation appears to be, it looks like it kills all the grass. So it may be something that spreads throughout the planet, and the shallow-rooted stuff, like grass, is killed by it. The deep-rooted stuff, like trees, some survive and some don't. So that the end result is that you end up with about one-third of maybe one of these regions wiped out by this one judgment.
Well, not only that, but the majority of animals that we eat.
The grazing animals in particular, right?
Off of grass.
That's right.
So they were gone.
That's right. So the life-sustaining properties of the planet just got hammered real good, didn't it, with this one trumpet judgment. And it gets worse. Second angel sounded, I'm at verse 8 now of chapter 8, and something like a great mountain burning with fire. Now, John wouldn't know what a meteor is, would he, or a comet. So he sees something, and he's not certain what it is, so he describes it as a mountain burning with fire. Now, is that not a reasonable description of a comet or a meteor or something like that for a guy that doesn't know what it is? Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it? So what John sees is some sort of celestial body thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, a third of the creatures which were in the sea had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Second system that is destroyed, as John sees, affects the oceans. Now, back in 1995, there was a comet that struck the planet Jupiter. The comet was called Shoemaker-Levy. That's the name of the astronomers that saw it first. This comet broke into 10 fragments as it entered Jupiter's gravitational field, broke into 10 pieces, and those 10 pieces then pounded Jupiter one right after the other. Okay, so here's this comet. By the way, Jupiter is it's kind of the guard dog of the universe. Its gravitational field is so strong because it's so big, it sucks all this space debris into its planet, keeps that stuff from hitting us and other planets. So it's there to purposely suck these things into it. It's by design that way. Well, when this comet broke up into these 10 pieces and struck Jupiter's surface, you can see this stuff online, where just one right after another came and hit. Every one of those 10 fragments left an impact crater on Jupiter big enough that you could put the planet Earth in that crater. And that's just something flying around out there. Now, this ain't that. This ain't going to destroy the planet. This is going to destroy a third of the planet. But there's stuff out there that God can use and can direct to bring about these judgments anytime He gets good and ready. Not that big, obviously. This thing, whatever it is going to hit one of our three major oceans. We got the Indian Ocean, got the Atlantic, and we got the Pacific. So it looks like whatever this is, John calls it a mountain burning with fire. I'm going to call it a meteorite because I don't know what it is, but it's something like that. And it's going to destroy a third. What's going to destroy everything in that one ocean? So it's a third of the Earth's ocean. I don't know which one of the three or where it might hit. But wherever it hits, it's going to destroy the sea life, and the commerce that takes place on the oceans as a result of that. Did I tell you this stuff was going to be hard to believe? Now, can you imagine what the coastlines are going to look like when something that big hits one of our oceans? That's some artist's interpretation of what that may be like. Scientists think that if something like that were to hit the oceans, it would create a tsunami that could be anywhere from several hundred feet high that would travel across the oceans at maybe 1,000 miles an hour. And as it gets close to shore, it slows down, but it builds up in height. So by the time it would hit the shore, you're talking about maybe several hundred feet high. 20, 30 story buildings would be under this thing. And at the speed that it's moving at, it would knock a whole bunch of them down. And who knows how far inland it would go. What's the highest place in Florida? 6 feet? Something like that? I don't know. If you know, Florida's flat as a pancake. This thing could come across Florida and the Gulf area down there and all that stuff just inundated. It'd be no problem whatsoever. And we're not told anything about the effect of it, but we have to kind of imagine a little bit that something of that magnitude, not only does it mess up the oceans, destroys one of the oceans, one of the three major oceans of the planet, but the coastlines of, you know, whichever countries are on the edge of that ocean would be devastated. They couldn't help but be, could they? I mean, you take, if that thing happened right out here in the middle of the Atlantic, what the east coast of the U.S. would look like, or if it happened down here, what the west coast would look like. It's just inconceivable. You can't get your mind around this because it is just too huge. So the first life-supporting system of the planet, that which produces crops and things of that sort, has been destroyed by a third. Now the sea life, which supports life on this planet greatly, and the commerce on it, has been reduced by at least a third. And the third angel sounded, I'm at verse 10 now, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, again, another celestial body of some kind. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, which is a poisoned. And a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. The next thing that happens is that the fresh water supply gets hammered. I don't know if I brought a map of that or not. I'll just tell you about it. There are three places on the planet where about one-third of the fresh water supply exists. You know what one of them is? The Great Lakes. The Great Lakes contain about a third of the fresh water supply on the planet. There's another third over here in these lakes in eastern Africa, and then there's a third up in Lake Baikal in Russia. I forget exactly where it is up here. So there, here, and here are three possible targets that would make a lot of sense. One-third of the Earth's fresh water supply. You say, well, how could you contaminate the entire Great Lakes? They're just too massive. Well, remember, when these things come into the Earth's atmosphere, the meteors and so on, they typically heat up and explode. So it may be that the trajectory coming in of this thing could be that such that as it came in and exploded, it spread out enough that it actually then would hit in each of the Great Lakes and contaminate that water, and perhaps some of the feeder rivers and the rivers that come out of there. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know that's what it's going to be, but just something like that could happen. Or it could happen there to southeastern Africa, the Great Lakes of Africa. That is, it's busted up so that it ends up striking all of those areas. And it could hit in the Mississippi River and some of the big feeder rivers and stuff like that in this country or over in those other places as well. You know, we're not given the detail. John sees what he sees and writes down here for us. But this third system of the Earth's life-sustaining systems, the fresh water supply, it's now contaminated by a third. So you see what's happened so far? The crop-producing capability of the planet has now been reduced by a third. The saltwater life-sustaining functions have been reduced by a third. The freshwater supply has now been reduced by a third. And many people will die from it. It says right there that water becomes poisonous. You can't drink it because it was made bitter. And the fourth trumpet, verses 12 and 13, fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were smitten, so that a third of them might not be darkened, and a day might not shine for a third of it, and the light in the same way. These planetary items support life on this planet as well. If you don't have a third of the sun shining, what's your growing season all of a sudden? And the moon, you don't have tides, you don't have the light's reflection at night. All of these things are associated with the life-sustaining, life-supporting systems on this planet. And they all just got hammered by these four judgments. So in the first series of judgments, the seals, we see mankind being used to judge mankind. But in the first four trumpet judgments, we see God disabling, in effect, the life-sustaining systems of this planet. So that no matter where you live now, fresh water supply is hard to get. You can't go out and harvest shrimp from the Louisiana coastline down there anymore because it doesn't exist, or something like that. So these four judgments, these trumpet judgments, strike at the heart of the planet and its ability to sustain life. And in each case, it's cut back by a third. So is it sensible to think that maybe a third of life on the planet might be lost as a result of this? Seems reasonable anyway, doesn't it? We know a fourth will be from the war. This could easily be another third. And we'll see another one in a little bit that we know is a third because we're told. So as you can imagine now, the death rate on the planet is extraordinarily high. And some of these things, as I say, are so difficult to grasp that we just struggle with believing them. The magnitude is just enormously huge. All right, I think we'll stop here and save the last three trumpets for the next week because they kind of come together as a little bit of a deal package too. So the first four seals are sort of a package deal, war and inevitable consequences. The first four trumpet judgments is kind of a package deal, impacting the life-sustaining systems that the Earth is designed with that God put in place in the beginning. And believe it or not, it gets worse. Any questions about anything we've seen here so far? Not going to ask you to actually describe for us how all this takes place, but you're getting a feel for the general flavor of how devastating and destructive and death-ridden these judgments are.
But I don't see God's mercy in this. In the 13th verse, when he says, I'm telling you, all of this is going to happen. You know, I'm telling you all this is going to happen.
Isn't
by
it?
By his design.
Yeah.
His mercy is still there.
It's interesting to note that I was thinking about this during the Christmas holidays, that the messaging of the first Advent, Christmas, when the Lord came the first time, is a message of forgiveness, salvation. The Lord came and offered to mankind payment for his sins. Wonderful message for mankind, isn't it? The other side of that messaging is what we're seeing here.
Exactly.
If you reject that offer that God made to you of providing a Savior for your sins, there is both temporal and eternal judgment to deal with, and we're seeing some of the temporal aspects here in these judgments. This planet is being dealt with by this non-believing planet, this Christ-rejecting planet, is being dealt with by God through these judgments. And they're both relationships is on the continuum between God and man. You have the Christmas messaging and you have the second Advent messaging. And if you reject the first Advent messaging, this is in your future in a way. Any questions or comments about this? All right, I'm going to shut up and give you a chance to go by the calorie table back here in the back. Now, Pam assures me that stuff is all no cow, so don't worry about eating all of it that you want. She assures me of that. So help yourself, and we'll see you next week, and Happy New Year.